I was very interested in the unspoken thoughts and feelings of the patient, because I think one of the things about free association is that in the beginning, most of what's going on with the patient is unsaid. And as the analysis evolves, it seems to me, more and more of the unspoken becomes spoken, and more of it becomes at the center of the analytic space. So I wanted to show the evolution of the unsaid. Okay. In the beginning of the book, the unsaid is more than the said. And then it evolves as the analysis goes on.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This podcast consists of conversations with psychoanalysts from around the world who share with us their clinical and psychoanalytic work with individuals both on and off the couch. And what we mean by off the couch is that they share with us their community involvement in many different venues apart from their consultation rooms. They describe their work in hospitals, in community clinics, in refugee centers, in classrooms, indeed in war zones. We also have conversations with psychoanalysts who are focusing their work on the couch, and they are continuing to refine both our familiar and novel understandings of the dynamic mind as it presents itself in the analytic situation. We've been talking to elders in our field, people who've been practicing for 50 plus years, and they share with us how they view this field evolving and where they see it going. We also talk to clinicians who had professions prior to becoming psychoanalysts, and they share with us their journeys to doing what they now love. These are just samplings of the psychoanalysts we've been talking with, again, from all corners of the globe. Please visit our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can subscribe, where you can see the recommended readings provided by our guests, and you can also leave a comment. I hope you enjoy these conversations and find them thoughtful and meaningful, and I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Roberta Satow. Roberta Satow is a practicing psychoanalyst in Washington, Connecticut, and a retired professor of sociology at Brooklyn College in New York City. And the focus of our conversation today is twofold. A, it's about her life both in sociology and in psychoanalysis, and how they add to each other, perhaps, and perhaps there may be tension with each other, and how one resolves having two mindsets. But from there, we go to a book she's written. It's called Our Time is Up. And just as her two mindsets of her professions, this book is both a memoir and a novel. It describes a young woman who was a sociologist and pursued psychoanalysis and became an analyst, as Roberta did. And the book describes that analysis in great detail. And we discuss in what ways it is true to analysis and in what ways it is a very fictionalized version of analysis. But for me, the net of it is that it does communicate an aliveness between the two people and a healing process between the two people that is true to analysis, while the techniques and mechanics may be fictionalized. The best way I can represent that is at the very end of the book, she has the character, the patient, say about the analyst who she names Joan. She says, "Frida Kahlo said about Diego Rivera, he took me shattered and returned me in one piece, whole." And she goes on to say, "I could say the same thing about Joan." Roberta is also a writer. She not only wrote this book, Our Time is Up, she's written another novel called Two Sisters of Coyoacan, which we discuss, and she's also written nonfiction, one book called Gender and Social Life, and also a book whose title I love. It says, Doing the Right Thing, Taking Care of Your Elderly Parents, Even If They Didn't Take Care of You. I thoroughly enjoyed our conversation, and we spent time with her reading from the book and discussing what she reads, and I think it's a very alive and lively experience, and I hope you enjoy it as I did. Here's my conversation with Roberta Satow. Roberta, welcome to the podcast. So good to have you.
Good to be here.
Roberta, most of our colleagues that have careers prior to becoming analysts tend to leave those careers behind. They feel that they have found what is true to them, and they immerse themselves in this new work of functioning as an analyst. Your path is a little bit different. Mm-hmm. You were interested and pursued a career in sociology, and indeed became a professor of sociology at Brooklyn College in New York City. And you also trained and practiced as a psychoanalyst at the same time. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to ask you in a moment about that two-ness, that you're living in both worlds. Mm-hmm. But we're also here today to talk about your book, which I have here, and it's called Our Time is Up, which is a phrase you use often in the book, because the book consists of the recounting, in quotes, of a young woman's psychoanalysis. Mm-hmm. And that, too, is characterized by two-ness, just as you've been a sociologist and an analyst. This book is both a novel and a memoir. And you make that very clear, that this describes your own analysis partly and is in part fictional. Mm-hmm. And the temptation, of course, as when we listen to patients is, well, is this true? Is this fantasy? Is this imagination? Is to try to say, well, is it true? And we'll take up that whole question of the is it true or isn't it true and how it does or doesn't matter. But start us off with your early career. What drew you to becoming a sociologist?
Well, actually, I was interested in becoming a psychoanalyst from a very early age. From the time that I was 11 or 12 years old, I immersed myself in reading things like I Never Promised You a Rose Garden and A 50-Minute Hour. And my closest friend in middle school, her father was a psychiatrist and a psychoanalyst. So I knew about psychoanalysis. And in fact, I was always a kid who didn't have any money, and I was always looking for jobs. And once her father hired me to write Christmas cards to all his patients, which I later realized was very strange. At the time, even at the time, I think I knew it was strange. And he let me go to he sent me to his office to go through the files and get the addresses of his patients to write them Christmas cards. And I started reading all the files. I got completely immersed in all his case files. So I knew from an early time that's what I was interested in.
Let me just ask you a question about that, because what you're describing, like you say, is outlandish. Were the patients' names included in these files that you were reading?
Yeah, it was completely boundary busting. Yes.
Wow. Yes. Okay. Yes. That's an unfortunate beginning in that way, but
yes, it was. It was completely. I knew that. I mean, I had some sense that this was not kosher.
Nevertheless,
right. I did read through all these files. I stayed there like all day long. The Christmas cards were the least of it. So I was very, very immersed in my own history, my own relationship with my mother and my own psyche. And I felt that when I went to college, that if I majored in psychology, at the time I thought that if I majored in psychology, it was going to be clinical psychology. I didn't realize I could have majored in psychology, and right. It would have had nothing to do with that. It would have been everything but. But anyway, I decided I shouldn't major in psychology. I should major in something that was very external, that would take me out of myself. So I ended up majoring in political science. And I got very interested in Russian history. And the two came together because I first started thinking I was going to major, I was going to be a Russian historian, but I couldn't learn Russian. So I gave that one up. So then in political science, I became very interested in Marxist theory.
So many people did at that time.
Right.
Right.
And so I was very interested in Russian history and Marxist theory. And I decided that I would go to graduate school and in political sociology, which I had a better chance of getting a fellowship in political sociology than political science. So I went with political sociology. And I went to NYU and got my PhD in sociology. But as soon as I finished my PhD in sociology, basically, the following fall, I enrolled in psychoanalytic training.
Now, let me take smaller steps. So you pursued sociology to not be attuned to what you thought was going on in your mind?
Not to be attuned to it, but to have a break from it. Okay. I felt like I was obsessed with it. It was all I thought about. It was all I talked to my friends about because my friends were into it as well.
It was sort of rumination more than self-awareness. I see.
Yes. I felt it like it was a self-awareness gone.
Haywire. Sure.
Yes. Yes.
And did it work? Did your immersion in the world of sociology offer you that break?
Well, in a way it did, because when I, as you pointed out in the in your introduction, I was a professor of sociology and a psychoanalyst at the same time. And I found the alternation actually to be extremely satisfying and helpful for me, because I would literally on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, I was lecturing on Marx and Weber and all sorts of things like that. And on Tuesday and Thursday, I was listening very intently to patients and engaging in their analytic journey.
Well, let me ask you about that, because I've had conversations with colleagues who had other careers before functioning as analysts. For example, physicians in different specialties, and they would say that they would struggle at times in listening to their patients, because when the patients started describing physical symptoms or medical journeys of their own or family members, they would be challenged to not listen as a physician attending to the problem, but instead as an analyst attending to the process. And what was that like for you? Because you had both a sociologic point of view and an internal point of view. And was there struggle? Were they additive in a good way? Were they conflicting with each other?
For the most part, I did not have that conflict at all. I think it was rarely that I did. For example, I did have a patient who was a Puerto Rican patient. She was from Puerto Rico, first generation, and had a lot of issues about her sexuality and her gender identity. And I think in that case, and I did write an article actually about that case, about the confluence of the certain cultural attitudes about penises and about penis envy and this woman's own feelings about her own sexuality. So in that one case, I think that there was overlap in a positive way. I don't think it interfered in the treatment in any way. I think it gave me a deeper understanding of the intensity of her feelings.
Well, let me ask you, and it's jumping ahead a little bit, but now that we're on the topic, of course, there's a great deal of conversation nowadays in our field about the presence, role, the understanding, the misunderstanding of cultural factors,
yes,
how they live inside the analyst and analysand and inside the process between them. Mm-hmm. What do you bring to that conversation, given your expertise in both areas?
Well, I think that in the case in with that patient, for example, I think that my sociological background gave me I think it opened me up more to her experience and not bringing to bear sort of the assumptions of the dominant assumptions about gender and about sexuality, because that was a long time ago. That was like 50 years ago before people were really talking about sexuality as a continuum and so on.
Uh-huh. So you're having an attunement to different cultures and the attitudes that are embedded in those cultures that enabled your analytic listening to deepen and broaden.
I think in that particular case, in general, I would say I kept them pretty separate.
Okay.
And I wouldn't say that my analytic listening was really changed by my sociological interests.
Okay. So let's jump ahead. So you're functioning as a sociologist and you sign up for psychoanalytic training. And what was it like making that switch? You went from being one kind of student to a different kind of student. Now, had you started your own analysis at that point?
Yes. I started my analysis as soon as I came back from college. So I was 21 years old, just like Rose in the book.
Right.
Yeah. And indeed, I went to Washington Square Institute, and that's where I started my analysis. I had already been in analysis for like 4 years before I started my psychoanalytic training.
I understand. Okay. Walk us through a little bit what it was like for you to learn and train as an analyst, especially after training as a sociologist and actually being a professor of sociology. What was that focus inward? What was it like in the face of all the ruminations you were trying to get away from?
Well, I think it felt for the most part like I had finally accepted who I was, that I had finally come home. I think going back to your earlier point, I think I was very sensitized to the male orientation of psychoanalysis. Okay. In my reading of psychoanalytic works, I would very often bring up gender issues, for example, in the classes that other people didn't bring up. And so there, I think my sociology really did have an effect.
And what years are we talking about now?
We're talking 1972.
Okay. So over 50.
I finished my PhD in 1972 and I enrolled at NPAP in fall of 1972.
Okay. And how did you find the transition from being a lecturing professor to someone behind the couch? Very, very different states of mind. Eh?
Yes, certainly. I didn't find any conflict between them because it was like there were these two sides of me,
right,
two parts of me that were being called out on different days.
Okay. All right.
You know, so it didn't feel conflictual at all.
All right. And during this time, do I have the trajectory correct? You also began writing, because that's another career you have as a fiction and nonfiction writer.
Well, at that time I was writing academic things because you had to publish, you know, it was a publish or perish situation. I guess it still is. So that's still consistent, I guess. But my publications, my early publications were in theory or in sociological theory. I wrote about, Max Weber and his theory of value rational authority. Even when I wrote about things that were touched on psychoanalysis, I wrote things like Where Has All the Hysteria Gone, which was about, this, in a sense, the evolution of the concept of hysteria.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then I moved from that to starting to be interested in things that were related to my life. So my next project was I did a study of weekenders in Washington, Connecticut, where I actually had a weekend home in Washington, Connecticut. And I did a study of the people, the attitudes of the people in Washington, Connecticut towards the New Yorkers who were gentrifying it and the people who were the gentrifiers themselves. So it was a kind of a class and status analysis of weekending. And
it also was an intermixing of your personal experience.
Yes.
And your intellectual academic experience, which is a thread that runs through much of your work.
Yes, it does. Yes.
Right. Tell us about the fiction and Trotsky. You have all this fun information about Trotsky. Let the listener in on that.
Okay. So, So first I did the Weekender study, which was, as you point out, an integration of my personal life and my work life. Then I did a book about caregiving. That was the next thing. Okay. And I wrote a book called Doing the Right Thing, Taking Care of Your Elderly Parents, Even If They Didn't Take Care of You.
And I want to underline what a brilliant title I think that is.
Thank you.
Well, why don't you say it again? Because it captures so much and such difficulty that so many have. And I presume, staying on point, that it also represents your own story.
Yes.
So again, the name of the book is?
Doing the Right Thing, : Taking Care of Your Elderly Parents, Even If They Didn't Take Care of You.
Yeah.
And in that book, part of the book was first person, my experience of being the primary caregiver for my mother, who had dementia. And the other part of it was I interviewed 100 caregivers across the country. See, I'm used to being the interviewer like you.
Right. Yeah.
And talking about their experiences of caregiving. So the book, again, was a combination of the personal with the sociological.
And how do you go from there to Trotsky?
Okay. So that book was the first time that I wrote in first person. Everything else I had ever written, I had always written, as I said, from an academic point of view,
right.
So it was always in third person. But I, in doing the right thing, a lot of it is first person. And I realized that I really was interested in writing in first person. And so I started this book, Our Time Is Up, after doing the right thing. But what happened was I sent the idea to my agent, and my agent hated the main character, which was very upsetting since I was the main character. So she hated the main character. She said the main character isn't sympathetic at all. So I put that book aside. No. Okay. And then,
by the way, that wasn't my experience at the slightest. I don't know if what I read had anything to do with what your agent read, but I don't share the sense that your main character is unsympathetic. She's a struggling young woman.
Right. But she had a lot of trouble, I think, with her anger. Okay. That really turned her off.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So I put the book aside, and then my husband and I went on a vacation. We went to Mexico City. Now, my husband is an ABD historian. So when we went to Mexico, and when I was in college, as I told you, I majored in political science, and I wrote my undergraduate thesis on Trotsky. Okay.
Let me just, for the listeners, ABD means all but dissertation. Right. Okay. Go ahead.
Right. So he's a trained historian.
Yes.
And so we go to Mexico City on vacation. And of course, both of us want to go to Coyoacan, which was the home of Frida Kahlo. And Frida Kahlo invited Trotsky at one point to come and stay in her house in Koyukon. He lived there for a couple of years, and at the time that Stalin was trying to murder him, okay, he was in exile, hiding in mm-hmm. in Mexico. So we went to Koyukon, and we went on a tour of Frida Kahlo's house. It's called the Blue House. And the docent told us this story about how there were two attempts on Trotsky's life. The first attempt, he escaped by a hair. Okay, his grandson was under the bed and was shot, I think, in the foot. And after that attempt on his life, they made the place into a fortress. Okay, it was impossible to get in there. So Stalin was still trying to murder him. So the Stalinists thought up this way of getting into the compound. And what they thought about was this. What they did was this. Trotsky had a secretary, and the secretary turned out to be from Brooklyn. And that was actually a Jewish girl from Brooklyn who came from a very wealthy real estate family in Brooklyn. And so what they did was they had a Stalinist agent seduce her sister in Paris. And then the boyfriend and her sister came to visit her in Koyukon. And of course, that was the entree to get into the house. And then it was her boyfriend who murdered Trotsky.
That's quite a story.
Yes. Yes. So that's what I thought. Quite a story. Okay. And then a year or two later, a patient of mine who is herself an analyst came into her session and said, "Did you read Ruth Polis's obituary?" Which I hadn't. And so she started telling me about it. She said Ruth Polis had been Trotsky's secretary, and she had come from a wealthy Brooklyn Jewish family and gone to Mexico City and ended up being his secretary. And her sister's boyfriend was the one who murdered Trotsky. Well, then I was totally blown away when these two stories came together. And at that point, I decided that I would write a novel, a historical novel based on this these two characters, these two sisters. And the name of that book is Two Sisters of Koyukon.
There's so much more I'd like to ask you, but I want to make sure we have sufficient time to devote ourselves to your book, Our Time is Up. Okay. Now, let me share with you and the listener my experience of reading this book, which I enjoyed. Obviously, I enjoyed because we wouldn't be having this conversation otherwise. It was a very nice read. And it was a nice read. A layperson reading this book would come away with two important impressions. The first is that analysis is a process that can dramatically and beneficially change a person's life. And That's point one. And the second point they would take away from reading this is that the vehicle for that change is the struggle in the relationship between the two parties within the dyad. Those are the two, for me, take-home messages. I call it, for me, this is an essence book that you capture a fundamental truth about analysis, as I describe those two examples for me. At the same time, it's very important to appreciate that this is not a book on psychoanalytic technique. And when you and I had spoken before, and I shared that observation, you sort of smiled and laughed with me, because of course it's not a book on psychoanalytic technique. And the example that jumps out for me, and it resonated for you, is your character, Rose, will often go into a session with some pressing problem in her life, either externally or internally. She might have a dream at the same time. She will present it to her analyst. Her analyst will reflect on it in some wise, pithy way and will say something just right. And the patient will leave the office with that situation solved.
Yes.
And we know that's not how it works. Not that it never works that way, but it mostly doesn't work that way.
Right.
This doesn't demonstrate technique.
No.
But it offers something very valuable, like the books you mentioned, I Never Promised You a Rose Garden or The 50-Minute Hour, which both of which made impressions on me very early in my life, and I think many, many people. They, too, were not texts on psychoanalytic technique. They're essence books. They're trying to represent an intensity and an intimacy that can really grow a person's life. And I thought the best way we can share this with our listeners is for you to read sections of it. Mm-hmm. And the first section starts at the beginning. Now, we know that patients, all of us, develop imaginings, fantasies about our analyst. The first moment we think of talking to an analyst, it just in our minds, there's a whole slew of imaginings that are associated with it. And as we get closer to the event of meeting this person, it gets richer and richer, and then we meet the person. And I'm going to ask you to start reading on page 4, the very beginning of the book, where this encounter takes place. And forgive me, because I'm going to interrupt you at various times, because there are a lot of riches to be had in this, but let me turn it over to you.
Okay. I had imagined how her face, how her voice would sound. I didn't want a therapist exuding WASP elitism like Katharine Hepburn. I knew I'd never feel comfortable talking to someone who seemed so superior in social background. My Brooklyn accent would intensify and I'd feel like a schlep. A husky, sexy voice like Lauren Bacall, on the other hand, would render me mute from envy. A high-pitched or nasal voice would evoke my contempt, and I wouldn't be able to take her seriously. I sighed with relief when I heard Joan's voice. It was an intelligent and engaging, but it was intelligent and engaging, but mellow and warm, the kind of voice you could snuggle up to. "Please come in," Joan said. She stood next to the Danish modern desk with a black vinyl swivel chair that was turned to face a deep-seated chair across the small room. It was a chair you might find in a dorm room, a piece of coarse cloth hung on a curved metal base. It had no arms, and I imagined that when I sank into it, my behind was going to be inches from the floor. The room was designed to be innocuous, probably to encourage patients to experience it in any way they needed, but I felt humiliated by it. There were a few prints on the wall, Picasso's Old Guitarist, a Miro abstract, and A Farm with Haystacks by Van Gogh. They looked familiar. I'd seen prints just like them in dorm rooms. Pleased that I'd recognized them, I felt cultured. Joan was quiet. Shifting around, I finally settled into the bottomless chair and folded my hands on my lap. My shoulders sagged. "Well, I'm an only child and I grew up in Brooklyn. I just got back to New York after graduating from the University of California. Berkeley had the best political science department in the United States, so I decided to major in that." "Yes," she beckoned me to continue. "When I left Brooklyn to begin college, I got the cheapest ticket to San Francisco, a chartered propeller plane that had to refuel on the way. The flight took 10 hours. I sat next to a girl named Maria who was returning from her junior year abroad in Florence on the same airplane, so she'd been crunched up in her seat by the window for almost 2 days. The part of me that wanted to entertain Joan gained steam. She was playing with her gold hoop earrings while she listened. She had pieces of smelly tuna fish under her seat and a bent and tattered version of Dante's Inferno in Italian. The words came out in a torrent. She was lovely, but her body odor was overwhelming. I guess I just got used to it. We had one of those intense conversations you only have with people you'll never see again. By the time we were over Michigan, we knew each other intimately."
Let me just pause you for the moment. And one of the pleasures I had in this introduction to the two of you, and it continues, is your focus on the physical. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that fiction can offer us that nonfiction can't is it lets our mind play. And what's often missing in our analytic literature is the presence of the analyst's body in the room and in the imagination of the analyst's hand. And you address that, you remedy that, you bring us into the room and you show us what you saw when you saw Joan and you noticed her body. Mm-hmm. And you go on to describe, and I'm going to not interrupt you in just a second, but you go on to describe her physicalness, her eyes, her ankles, not just the room, but her physicalness, which turns out to play a theme throughout the course of your description of the treatment that goes on. And I just want to appreciate your bringing us into the physical space that you were struck with.
Well, I want to just say something about that, I think. Mm-hmm. I was very interested in the unsaid, the unspoken thoughts and feelings of the patient. Because I think one of the things about free association that is that in the beginning, the patient is, most of what's going on with the patient is unsaid. and it as the analysis evolves, it seems to me, more and more of the unspoken becomes spoken. And more of it becomes, you know, becomes this at the center of the analytic space. So I wanted to show the evolution of the unsaid. Okay, in the beginning of the book, the unsaid is more than the said, and then it evolves as the analysis goes on.
It's a great description. Go ahead. Why don't you continue?
Okay. Joan's blue eyes reflected the light. The more intently she listened, the more I embellished the story. She told me about her boyfriend, Johnny, from Oakland, who was going to pick her up at the airport. My Brooklyn accent got thicker. My R's were dropping like flies, and my voice kept rising. I told her all about my mother and why I had to get away from her. Joan sat with her legs crossed at the ankles. I noticed they were not the kind of ankles with protruding bones like I have. They were thicker. You could barely see the bones on the side. Joan switched from playing with her earrings to playing with a tussle of her hair as she listened. When the pilot announced we were landing in San Francisco in 20 minutes, Maria asked if I was taking a cab to Berkeley. I told her I planned to walk over the Bay Bridge to Berkeley and stay at the Y. Can you imagine? She laughed and I really felt embarrassed. There was something stupid about walking over the bridge to Berkeley, but I didn't know what it was. I wondered if Joan knew how stupid it was to think of walking over the Bay Bridge. From the map, I just assumed the airport was near the bridge and I could walk over it. Isn't that incredible? It's over 20 miles from the airport to the campus. Luckily, she and Johnny took me to the co-op dorm. Waiting for her to respond, I worried that she might think I was just babbling. "Didn't your parents go over your plans with you?" Joan asked. There was something concealed in a fold in her voice. Her tone implied that my parents should have gone over the plans with me. "No, my parents never asked about my plans," I sighed. "Once they decided to let me go, they had no interest in my accommodations or the cost." I glanced at Joan to see if she was surprised, but she just looked concerned. "I never had seen a real palm tree," I continued, "only pictures of them on postcards my parents' friends sent while on vacation in Florida. And I had never seen a eucalyptus tree. I thought it was a type of cough drop. They're so weird looking, strings of hanging bark and joints like armpits or crotches." Should I continue?
Yes, please. But I just want to enjoy again, as I did when I read it, how raw your representation of this character is. She's so self-conscious, though she's aware of her self-consciousness, which is refreshing. Mm-hmm. She's so critical. She's embarrassed. And it really, it is said that the first dream describes the whole analysis, or the first session describes the whole analysis. And that's true in this description as well. Mm-hmm. The themes that she's representing in the conversation with her airplane partner and the awkwardness of beginning school in California is what we follow in the whole story as it gets lived out between the two of them. And it's just beautifully done. So let me not interrupt. Why don't you continue on?
Joan smiled. When I got to the girls' cooperative dormitory, Stebbins Hall, I stood on the steps with my bag, having sent my trunk ahead of time, and knocked on the door. I had no idea it wasn't open, open yet for the fall semester. I wanted to emphasize the strangeness of what I did. Luckily, the house mother succumbed to my pleas and let me stay in one of the empty rooms. I had no place to go. I pictured the white-haired house mother wearing a skirt and silk blouse, although she was just spending the day in the co-op. She had a bloodless elegance that Jews don't have. I rubbed my palms on my thighs. When she gave me two sheets to make my bed, I asked her if it was one for each week. I hoped Joan would laugh, but she only smiled. In Brooklyn, we didn't sleep between two sheets. My mother had a duvet cover on her comfort on the comforter, and we used a fitted bottom sheet. The house mother informed me in a loud voice, slowly enunciating as if I didn't understand English. One is the bottom sheet, and one is the top sheet. Now Joan was laughing. I liked the idea that she was trying to contain herself, but couldn't help it.
And in addition to all that awkward self-consciousness, there's also delightful humor in your description. But what also comes across, you've probably mentioned Brooklyn at least a half a dozen times in our conversation today. And you are from Brooklyn, and the characters from Brooklyn. And Trotsky's secretary, so we learned, was also from Brooklyn, right?
Yes.
So that's an important part of you and your story and your relationship with Joan, who was not from Brooklyn.
Yes.
Gets dealt with and played out. Is there anything you want to add to that for us about how that lives for you as an analyst and as an analyst in your life, your cultural history?
Well, I was, first of all, you know, I didn't realize until many years later, but Brooklyn is very large and there's very, has very distinct neighborhoods in it. I was from a neighborhood that was a predominantly Jewish neighborhood. It had a lot of Italian people and Irish people as well, but it was mostly a Jewish neighborhood. And my association to who I was very much lodged in this notion of I'm a Brooklyn Jew. Okay. And it was only years later where I would meet people who were from Brooklyn and they weren't Jewish. They came from other parts of Brooklyn, right. And they had whole different experiences of Brooklyn. And of course, Brooklyn has completely changed from the time that I grew up. But that was an identity for me, okay, being a Brooklyn Jew. And it was very condensed in terms of the layers of meaning that it had for me. I mean, in the 1950s, for example, the concept of a nice Jewish girl, if one person, if people were talking to each other and they said, oh, she's a nice Jewish girl, they kind of understood what that meant. It means that, she's not going to have sex before marriage. She's going to be smart. She's going to,
the stereotype, right?
Exactly. It's a stereotype that was very central to my sense of who I was. That's that stereotype. And a lot of the analysis, it seems to me, that I'm describing here is about separation, but it's about because in terms of the themes that you talked about, a major theme in the book is about separation, the levels of separation, the end of a session, the end of a relationship, death, the growing up and leaving your parents behind, just different layers of separation. And one of the layers of separation was was the process by which Rose is learning that that this stereotype is not all of who she is. Okay, that she's much more than this stereotype that she keeps on insisting on. She herself keeps on insisting that this stereotype is who she is.
Because she doesn't have access to more of herself that would let her know otherwise.
In the beginning, yes.
And it sounds like, if I may, it sounds like your evolution from sociology to psychoanalysis, yeah? From outside labels to inner experiences?
Yes, interesting. Mm-hmm. Okay, yes. Yeah, okay.
You bring up her merging into herself, and I know I'm jumping ahead a lot. There's a lot in the book we could address, but let me ask you to read when Joan came out of her office to greet me.
Okay, on page
121.
When Joan came out of her office to greet me, I was shaken out of my trance. I followed her into the office and headed for the couch. I was about to take my shoes off when Joan asked me to sit up because she needed to speak to me. My heart throbbed. Something was terribly wrong. She had never started the session by talking to me. She always waited for me to say something. She hadn't seemed herself in the last few weeks. 3 weeks before, she had forgotten Linda's name, and the week before, I could tell she really wasn't listening when I told her a dream. Her nail polish was chipped, and there were still specks of it left on two of her fingers. No time for the nail salon either. Her usual sparkling blue eyes looked tired and dimmed by the dark bags under them. I had been angry at her for almost 2 years because she never started the session, and it was always incumbent on me to say something. Now that she was finally speaking first, I dreaded that she was sick or dying. I grabbed a pillow and propped myself up on the couch. When I settled in, there was a moment of silence. I could hear a slight wispy sound as I listened to my breathing. I dug my nails into my palms, trying to ready myself for the bad news that I knew was coming. I hummed silently, "I love you, true and blue like glue." Then Joan looked at me somberly and began to tell me what I had feared. "I have breast cancer and need to have an operation, so I'm going to have to stop seeing patients for a while." I winced as the salt in my tears ran into the cold sore on my lip. She spoke softly and simply, like a mother reassuring a young child. "I'm going to be all right, but I won't be able to work for a while." I thought about her breasts, so small and flat. I wondered how she found the tumor. Did she touch her breasts in the shower and feel a lump? That's the way my father's cousin Bertha found hers. Or was she in bed with a lover who felt a little bump? I pictured myself putting my arms around her and laying my head on her lap as I had longed to do for so long. I imagined her stroking my hair and saying, "I'm going to be back. Don't worry. I'm only going to be gone a little while, and then I'll be back." I wanted to hold on to her the way a child holds on to a parent who's going out the door. Flooded with regret for all the times I'd expressed anger at her and the loving moments I'd let pass silently, I wanted to yell, "I'm sorry. I'll be good. Please, don't leave." "I love you," I finally said. "You know that, don't you? I get angry at you all the time because I want so much from you, too much, more than you can possibly give or anyone can. I don't want you to be in pain. I'd do anything for you. I want you to be okay." "I know," she whispered. Joan folded her hands in her lap before she spoke. I thought she was trying not to weep. Her voice was stilted, and she spoke slowly. "The doctor says I have to have chemo and radiation after the operation, but I'll survive it. I can't work because I'll be sick from the chemo and then very tired from the radiation." I wanted to ask her a million questions. "Did you get a second opinion? Are you going to Sloan Kettering? What stage is it? Is there lymph node involvement? Are you having a mastectomy? How long will you be gone?" But somehow, even then, I knew those questions would not feel good to her. I understood that asking sick people about their medical details was an expression of anxiety that was like pouring water into a cup that was already full. I wanted to soothe and reassure her. "Can I visit you?" I whispered. Let's talk about that, she said. I closed my eyes. How would it feel for you to visit me, she asked. Her voice looked puffy, as if she'd been crying a lot. For the first time, I noticed the brown spots on her cheeks, like the skin of an apricot. I'd never felt she was vulnerable before. A wave of sadness washed over me. I think it would feel good, I said. Our relationship had been all about my wanting Joan to love me, to care about me in a way that my mother never did. There had been no room for me to give her anything, to take care of her. She had done all the giving. I want to give you something. Did your mother allow you to give to her? She asked quietly. Taking a tissue from the dispenser on the table, I wiped my face, but it was too late. My blouse was already damp from the runoff. Ironically, I said, I think she was constantly angry and complaining that no one took care of her, but she couldn't take it in. If I put my arms around her when she was sad, she never put her arms around me. It was always one way. She made constant demands, but she never asked for a hug. Don't you know, telling me how you feel about me is giving me something, Joan said.
You know, each time I read that, I feel moved by it. That may relate to my own personal experiences as Anna Lassand, or maybe not. It's beautifully written. And whether it's true or not, that old question, it isn't really the point. It's true in terms of the relationship between these two people as you represent it. And one could have a class on technique from these two pages. I mean, one can select any one of the exchanges and spend time discussing it. That comes to mind because of the last sentence you read, don't you know telling me how you feel about me is giving me something? It's one of those moments when patients want to give us a gift, and we may feel that a greater gift than a tangible gift is them sharing with us the feelings behind the gift. But that may not be true for them. And when you have the analyst saying, don't you know, telling me how you feel about me is giving me something, it sounded, that brought to mind those kinds of situations where, yeah, says who? Says who that that's the preferred gift. The other thing that jumps out of it is when she reassures you, supposedly, as opposed to herself, that, oh, I'll be back. I'll be back. And that's the whole subject of when the analyst gets ill, which is a topic that has been fairly widely written about. Again, I've been involved in that literature as well. And denial is something we can't ask analysts not to have. We can't because we'll be disappointed, number one, but it's not reasonable to ask analysts not to have denial. We are first and foremost human beings, and we are frightened for our mortality. And I think denial is ubiquitous, which is the case for this character too. You have her reassuring you, but of course she is reassuring herself.
Right.
And in that spirit, let me ask you to read this final section when you were asked to give a eulogy for her at her funeral.
I was standing in front of a large room filled with people who knew and loved Joan. Rachel, her father, and Joan's brother and his wife and children, a wife and children, were sitting in the front row with Maria. Many of the people there were psychoanalysts, and I knew a lot of them. Others were Joan's former patients. The Lilliputian held a fistful of tissues that she pressed to her puffy eyes. The rest were family and friends who I didn't know. I loved Joan, my voice started to crack immediately. Frida Kahlo said about Diego Rivera, he took me shattered and returned me in one piece, whole. I could say the same thing about Joan. I wiped my tears with a white cotton handkerchief. I first went to see Joan when I was 21 and stayed in treatment with her for about 4 years. My eyes met the eyes of the lawyer in the third row, whose black mascara left a trail down her cheek. Indeed, I was one of her first patients. I smiled at her to indicate I knew she was one of the first as well. Some analyses feel like the analyst and patient are observing a pond or a lake together. The muscles in my neck and shoulders relaxed. I saw Anne sitting in the back, smiling at me with her handkerchief at the ready. There are frogs and tadpoles, water lilies floating to the surface with underwater stems rooted in the mud below. There's zooplankton and other varieties of algae and fish with different colors and textures. It's very calm on the surface, but underneath, when you analyze dreams and associations, there's passion, fighting, alcoholism, parents abandoning children, incest, or a whole bunch of other things. My analysis, on the other hand, was more like an ocean. I was heaving so intensely that I couldn't speak for a minute. There were gigantic waves and a severe undertow. There were tiger sharks, lionfish, stingrays, and poison jellyfish in the water. They weren't deep under the water, but close to the surface. No diving was necessary. We didn't have to analyze my dreams or follow my associations to observe my aggression. I yelled at her regularly. The attacks, stings, and poisonous barbs emerged in the sessions repeatedly. I don't think there are many analysts who would have survived with me in those waters, but Joan was comfortable in that turbulent sea. The handkerchief I'd brought was a crumpled ball of tears and snot. At one point, I'd been so enraged at her for such a protracted period that her unconscious overtook her and she went shopping instead of coming to my session. The therapists in the audience laughed, and the patients were horrified, putting their hands over their mouths or grimacing in pain. We analyzed it, and it was a turning point in the treatment. I always felt that whatever emerged in the treatment, we would analyze it, and it would be okay. More grist for the mill, as Joan always said. I mopped my cheeks again. Being a psychoanalyst differs from most other kinds of work. It's not simply a job in which you behave in a particular role or perform a variety of services. Rather, doing psychoanalysis involves using yourself, and Joan's sense of self was unwavering. No matter what I threw at her, she rarely faltered in giving a calm transference interpretation. I accused her angrily, "You don't love me," but she was unflappable. Most of the time, she calmly tolerated my disappointment and anger. She saw the yearning beneath. Joan always knew those feelings were about my mother and that she could not cure me simply by loving me. She understood all the pain that had to come out if I was going to move beyond it. Love is not enough when it's remedial. She taught me that, and it served me well as an analyst. You can't be fully engaged in the present unless you've slogged through the past. That's why allowing the transference to develop is so crucial in psychoanalytic work. While thinking about today, I continued, which I have been doing for a couple of months, I went back to a book that Joan often referred to during my analysis, The Little Prince. At one point, the fox says to the little prince, "If you tame me, then we shall need each other. To me, you shall be unique in the world. To you, I shall be unique in the world." Well, Joan tamed me, literally and figuratively, and to me, she was unique in all the world.
You know, I'm thinking back to my comment earlier when I introduced the book and I said I liked it and that's why we're having this conversation. I didn't mean for that to sound glib, because in hearing this again, these last two sections captured not why I liked it, but why it moved me and why I thought it was important. Because you really get the analytic experience. And even more than that, the reader really will get it from your getting it, that the intensity, the past, living in the present, the essential value of distinguishing the past in the present, and how that can free both parties up in a very special new way is a gift you have, not just to get it, but to be able to write it and for the reader to get it. And that's why I think your work is important and why I'm so glad to have this conversation with you so that others will know of it. So let me leave it at that, with that expression of appreciation for you and this book. It's called Our Time is Up. Your name is Roberta Satow, and you have a gift, and I look forward to your next book.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.